Chapter 102. False. Could the proud-spirited woman have behaved more like a child? But the strange words penetrated Mira with nothing but a sense of solemnity and indignation. With a sudden light in her eyes, and a tremor in her voice, she said, "Who are the people that say evil of him? I would not believe any evil of him, if an angel came to tell it me. He found me when I was so miserable I was going to drown myself. I looked so poor and forsaken. You would have thought I was a beggar by the wayside. And he treated me as if I had been a king's daughter. He took me to the best of women. He found my brother for me. And he honors my brother, though he too was poor, oh, almost as poor as he could be. And my brother honors him. That is no light thing to say." Here Mira's tone changed to one of profound emphasis, and she shook her head backward, "For my brother is very learned and great-minded. And Mr. Deronda says there are few men equal to him." Some Jewish defiance had flamed into her indignant gratitude, and her anger could not help including Gwendolyn, since she seemed to have doubted Deronda's goodness. But Gwendolyn was like one parched with thirst, drinking the fresh water that spreads through the frame as a sufficient bliss. She did not notice that Mira was angry with her. She was not distinctly conscious of anything but of the penetrating sense that Deronda and his life were no more like her husband's conception than the morning in the horizon was like the morning mixed with street gas. Even Mira's words sank into the indefiniteness of her relief. She could hardly have repeated them, or said how her whole state of feeling was changed. She pressed Mira's hand, and said, thank you, in a hurried whisper, then rose, and added, with only a hazy consciousness, I must go, I shall see you on the 4th. I am so much obliged, bowing herself out automatically, while Mira, opening the door for her, wondered at what seemed a sudden retreat into chill loftiness. Gwendolyn, indeed, had no feeling to spare in any effusiveness toward the creature who had brought her relief. The passionate need of contradiction to Grand Court's estimate of Deronda, a need which had blunted her sensibility to everything else, was no sooner satisfied than she wanted to be gone. She began to be aware that she was out of place, and to dread Deronda seeing her. And once in the carriage again, she had the vision of what awaited her at home. When she drew up before the door in Grosvenor Square, her husband was arriving with a cigar between his fingers. He threw it away, and handed her out, accompanying her upstairs. She turned into the drawing room, lest he should follow her farther, and give her no place to retreat to. Then she sat down with a weary air, taking off her gloves, rubbing her hand over her forehead, and making his presence as much of a cipher as possible. But he sat too, and not far from her just in front, where to avoid looking at him must have the emphasis of effort. "May I ask where you have been at this extraordinary hour?" said Grandcourt. "Oh, yes, I have been to Miss Lapidus, to ask her to come and sing for us," said Gwendolyn, laying her gloves on the little table beside her, and looking down at them. "And to ask her about her relations with Deronda?" said Grandcourt, with the coldest possible sneer in his low voice which in poor Gwendolyn's ear was diabolical. For the first time since their marriage she flashed out upon him without inward check. Turning her eyes full on his, she said, in a biting tone, "Yes, and what you said is false, a low, wicked falsehood." "She told you so, did she?" returned Grandcourt, with a more thoroughly distilled sneer. Gwendolyn was mute. The daring anger within her was turned into the rage of dumbness. What reasons for her belief could she give? All the reasons that seemed so strong and living within her, she saw them suffocated and shriveled up under her husband's breath. There was no proof to give, but her own impression, which would seem to him her own folly. She turned her head quickly away from him, and looked angrily toward the end of the room. She would have risen, but he was in her way. Grandcourt saw his advantage. "It's of no consequence so far as her singing goes," he said, in his superficial drawl. "Why, you can have her to sing, if you like." Then, after a pause, he added in his lowest imperious tone, "But you will please to observe that you are not to go near that house again. As my wife, you must take my word about what is proper for you. When you undertook to be Mrs. Grandcourt, you undertook not to make a fool of yourself. You have been making a fool of yourself this morning, and if you were to go on as you have begun, you might soon get yourself talked of at the clubs in a way you would not like. What do you know about the world? You have married me, and must be guided by my opinion. Every slow sentence of that speech had a terrific mastery in it for Gwendolyn's nature. If the low tones had come from a physician telling her that her symptoms were those of a fatal disease, and prognosticating its course, she could not have been more helpless against the argument that lay in it. But she was permitted to move now, and her husband never again made any reference to what had occurred this morning. He knew the force of his own words. If this white-handed man with the perpendicular profile had been sent to govern a difficult colony, he might have won reputation among his contemporaries. He had certainly ability, would have understood that it was safer to exterminate than to cajole superseded proprietors, and would not have flinched from making things safe in that way. Gwendolyn did not, for all this, part with her recovered faith. Rather, she kept it with a more anxious tenacity, as a Protestant of old kept his Bible hidden or a Catholic his crucifix, according to the side favored by the civil arm, and it was characteristic of her that apart from the impression gained concerning Deronda in that visit, her imagination was little occupied with Mirror the eulogized brother. The one result established for her was that Deronda had acted simply as a generous benefactor, and the phrase eating Hebrew had fleeted unimpressively across her sense of hearing, as a stray stork might have made its peculiar flight across her landscape without rousing any surprised reflection on its natural history. But the issue of that visit, as it regarded her husband, took a strongly active part in the process which made an habitual conflict within her, and was the cause of some external change perhaps not observed by anyone except Deronda. As the weeks went on bringing occasional transient interviews with her, he thought that he perceived, in her an intensifying of her superficial hardness and resolute display, which made her abrupt betrayals of agitation the more marked and disturbing to him. In fact, she was undergoing a sort of discipline for the refractory which, as little as possible like conversion, bends half the self with a terrible strain, and exasperates the unwillingness of the other half. Grandcourt had an active divination, rather than discernment of refractoriness in her, and what had happened about Mira quickened his suspicion that there was an increase of it dependent on the occasions when she happened to see Deronda. There was some unfounded nonsense between them. He did not imagine it exactly as flirtation, and his imagination in other branches was rather restricted. But it was nonsense that evidently kept up a kind of simmering in her mind and inward action which might become disagreeable outward. Husbands in the old time are known to have suffered from a threatening devoutness in their wives, presenting itself first indistinctly as oddity, and ending in that mild form of lunatic asylum, a nunnery. Grandcourt had a vague perception of threatening moods in Gwendolyn which the unity between them in his views of marriage required him peremptorily to check. Among the means he chose, one was peculiar, and was less ably calculated than the speeches we have just heard. He determined that she should know the main purport of the will he was making, but he could not communicate this himself, because it involved the fact of his relation to Mrs. Glasher and her children, and that there should be any overt recognition of this between Gwendolyn and himself was supremely repugnant to him. Like all proud, closely wrapped natures, he shrank from explicitness and detail, even on trivialities, if they were personal. A valet must maintain a strict reserve with him on the subject of shoes and stockings. And clashing was intolerable to him. His habitual want was to put collision out of the question by the quiet massive pressure of his rule. but he wished Gwendolyn to know that, before he made her an offer, it was no secret to him that she was aware of his relations with Lydia, her previous knowledge being the apology for bringing the subject before her now. Some men in his place might have thought of writing what he wanted her to know in the form of a letter. But Grandcourt hated writing. Even writing a note was a bore to him, and he had long been accustomed to have all his writing done by Lush. We know that there are persons who will forego their own obvious interest, rather than do anything so disagreeable, as to write letters, and it is not probable that these imperfect utilitarians would rush into manuscript and syntax on a difficult subject in order to save another's feelings. To Grandcourt it did not even occur that he should, would, or could write to Gwendolyn the information in question, and the only medium of communication he could use was Lush, who, to his mind, was as much of an implement as pen and paper. But here too Grandcourt had his reserves, and would not have uttered a word likely to encourage Lush in an impudent sympathy with any supposed grievance in a marriage which had been discommended by him. Who that as a confidant escapes believing too little in his penetration, and too much in his discretion. Grandcourt had always allowed Lush to know his external affairs indiscriminately irregularities, debts, want of ready money. He had only used discrimination about what he would allow his confidant to say to him. And he had been so accustomed to this human tool that the having him at call in London was a recovery of lost ease. It followed that Lush knew all the provisions of the will more exactly than they were known to the testator himself. Grandcourt did not doubt that Gwendolyn, since she was a woman who could put two and two together, knew or suspected Lush to be the contriver of her interview with Lydia, and that this was the reason why her first request was for his banishment. But the bent of a woman's inferences on mixed subjects which excites mixed passions is not determined by her capacity for simple addition, and here Grandcourt lacked the only organ of thinking that could have saved him from mistake, namely, some experience of the mixed passions concerned. He had correctly divined one half of Gwendolyn's dread, all that related to her personal pride, and her perception that his will must conquer hers. But the remorseful half, even if he had known of her broken promise, was as much out of his imagination as the other side of the moon. What he believed her to feel about Lydia was solely a tongue-tied jealousy, and what he believed Lydia to have written with the jewels was the fact that as he had once been used to wearing them, with other amenities such as he imputed to the intercourse with jealous women. He had the triumphant certainty that he could aggravate the jealousy, and yet smite it with a more absolute dumbness. His object was to engage all his wife's egoism on the same side as his own, and in his employment of Lush he did not intend an insult to her. She ought to understand that he was the only possible envoy. Grandcourt's view of things was considerably fenced in by his general sense that what suited him others must put up with. There is no escaping the fact that want of sympathy condemns us to corresponding stupidity. Mephistopheles, thrown upon real life, and obliged to manage his own plots, would inevitably make blunders. One morning he went to Gwendolyn in the boudoir beyond the back drawing room, hat and gloves in hand, and said with his best tempered, most persuasive drawl, standing before her, and looking down on her as she sat with a book on her lap, "Hey, Gwendolyn, there's some business about property to be explained. I have told Lush to come and explain it to you. He knows all about these things. I am going out. He can come up now. He's the only person who can explain. I suppose he will not mind." "You know that I do mind," said Gwendolyn, angrily, starting up. I shall not see him." She showed the intention to dart away to the door. Grandcourt was before her, with his back toward it. He was prepared for her anger, and showed none in return, saying, with the same sort of remonstrant tone that he might have used about an objection to dining out, "It's no use making a fuss. There are plenty of brutes in the world that one has to talk to. People with any savoir vivre don't make a fuss about such things. Some business must be done. You can't expect agreeable people to do it. If I employ Lush, the proper thing for you is to take it as a matter of course. Not to make a fuss about it. Not to toss your head and bite your lips about people of that sort. The drawling and the pauses with which this speech was uttered gave time for crowding reflections in Gwendolyn, quelling her resistance. What was there to be told her about property? This word had certain dominant associations for her, first with her mother, then with Mrs. Glasher and her children. What would be the use, if she refused to see Lush? Could she ask Grandcourt to tell her himself? That might be intolerable, even if he consented, which it was certain he would not, if he had made up his mind to the contrary. The humiliation of standing an obvious prisoner, with her husband barring the door, was not to be borne any longer, and she turned away, to lean against a cabinet, while Grandcourt again moved toward her. I have arranged for Lush to come up now, while I am out, he said, after a long organ stop, during which Gwendolyn made no sign. Shall I tell him he may come? Yet another pause, before she could say as her face turned obliquely and her eyes cast down. I shall come back in time to ride, if you like to get ready, said Grandcourt. No answer. She is in a desperate rage, thought he. But the rage was silent, and therefore not disagreeable to him. It followed that he turned her chin and kissed her, while she still kept her eyelids down, and she did not move them until he was on the other side of the door. What was she to do? Search where she would in her consciousness, she found no plea to justify a plaint. Any romantic illusions as he had in marrying this man had turned on her power of using him as she liked. He was using her as he liked. She sat awaiting the announcement of Lush as a sort of searing operation, that as he had to go through. The facts that galled her gathered a burning power, when she thought of their lying in his mind. It was all a part of that new gambling, in which the losing was not simply a minus, but a terrible plus, that had never entered into her reckoning. Lush was neither quite pleased nor quite displeased with his task. Grandcourt had said to him by way of conclusion, don't make yourself more disagreeable than nature obliges you. That depends, thought Lush. But he said, I will write a brief abstract for Mrs. Grandcourt to read. He did not suggest that he should make the whole communication in writing, which was a proof that the interview did not wholly displease him. Some provision was being made for himself in the will, and he had no reason to be in a bad humor, even if a bad humor had been common with him. He was perfectly convinced that he had penetrated all the secrets of the situation, but he had no diabolical delight in it. He had only the small movements of gratified self-loving resentment in discerning that this marriage had fulfilled his own foresight in not being as satisfactory as the supercilious young lady had expected it to be, and as Grandcourt wished to feign that it was. He had no persistent spite much stronger than what gives the seasoning of ordinary scandal to those who repeat it and exaggerate it by their conjectures. With no active compassion or goodwill, he had just as little active malevolence, being chiefly occupied in liking his particular pleasures, and not disliking anything but what hindered those pleasures, everything else ranking with the last murder and the last opera bouffe, under the head of things to talk about. Nevertheless, he was not indifferent to the prospect of being treated uncivilly by a beautiful woman, or to the counterbalancing fact that his present commission put into his hands an official power of humiliating her. He did not mean to use it needlessly, but there are some persons, so gifted in relation to us, that their "how do you do?" seems charged with offense. By the time that Mr. Lush was announced, Gwendolyn had braced herself to a bitter resolve that he should not witness the slightest betrayal of her feeling, whatever he might have to tell. She invited him to sit down with stately quietude. After all, what was this man to her? He was not in the least like her husband. Her power of hating a coarse, familiar-mannered man, with clumsy hands, was now relaxed by the intensity with which she hated his contrast. He held a small paper folded in his hand while he spoke. I need hardly say that I should not have presented myself, if Mr. Grandcourt had not expressed a strong wish to that effect, as no doubt he has mentioned to you. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.